my name is Tony Greenstein. I was the first Jewish person to be expelled from the Labour Party as part of the fake anti-Semitism allegations. I am an anti-Zionist and have been active around Palestine Solidarity
Okay,
and similar campaigns.
A lot of people, Tony, still don't understand this term Zionism. I know it sounds amazing, but it doesn't really get interrogated by the mainstream press. Can you just explain what Zionism actually is and why you're against it?
Yes, certainly. Thanks. Zionism is a political movement, and it was formed amongst Jews, a minority of Jews, a very small minority, in the 19th century, at the end of the 19th century. And its main aim was to solve what was called the Jewish question by establishing a Jewish state, and moreover a Jewish state in Palestine. The majority of Jews fiercely opposed it because what it said was that Jews were a separate nation or race, which is the exact opposite of what Jews were saying. They were saying we are part of the same society as you and should have the same rights. So there was a clear conflict, and Zionism was seen by many Jews as just a Jewish form of anti-Semitism, nothing more.
Well, okay. So, over the years, do you think some Jews have they've kind of fallen out of love with the idea of the Jewish state as this state has manifested itself today?
Yes, it's quite interesting. Of course, up to the war, then most Jews outside Palestine were not Zionists. It was only the Holocaust which converted them to Zionism. But today, when they see the brutal reality of the Israeli state, its military subjugation of the Palestinians, a lot of younger, more liberal Jews are pushing the Holocaust to one side and all of that and saying, no, this is unacceptable, what's happening in our name. Doesn't apply to the Board of Deputies and other Zionist organisations in Britain, which devote so much of their time and energy to supporting the apartheid state, but it's increasingly the case with other people.
I mean, some people have pointed out, very few, on the mainstream press again, that actually when Islam arrived in the Middle East, they forcibly converted the Jews and the Christians who were already there. I don't think guns were invented, but almost at the point of a gun, they were told, well, you've got to become Muslims and you can still like Jesus, you can still like Abraham and all that sort of thing. But unless you convert to Islam, you've got to, we're going to kill you. And so many of the people who are actually in the Holy Land now were originally Jews who were kind of coerced into it. And you do wonder whether, well, actually, at heart, maybe they're kind of old school Jews, even though they're supposedly Muslim, they're old school Jews or old school Christians. So this has happened in the intervening thousands of years or hundreds of years since the time of Christ, that it wasn't, for a long, long time, it was not an option to be a Jew or a Christian in that part of the world.
Well, it really depends, because Jews, hundreds of thousands of Jews did live in Arab countries. Iraq had over 100,000 Jews, for example. Egypt has a large population of Jews. So in practice, Jews and Muslims and Christians did actually live together. What happened in Europe did not happen in the Middle East. On the contrary, when you have the Spanish Inquisition, where did many Jews flee? It was to North Africa and the Muslims. So that's simply not true, but it's a mistake to look at Israel and what is happening now through a religious lens, if you like. It's not a religious question. It never was. The Jews who came from Europe were sponsored, of course, by Britain and other European powers. It was a question of European settler colonization. Jews were white Europeans, and that's what they did. But yes, it's true. The irony is, if anyone is descended from the Jews and the Hebrews of Palestine. It's the Palestinians, not the European Jews who came to dispossess them. There's a lot of evidence in terms of the perpetuation of customs in the Jewish religion, like lighting candles on the Friday, that the Palestinians have the best claim. So that is the irony. I mean, what's happening, you could say, is a form of anti-Semitism, but it is a form of racism, certainly.
Well, sorry, I shouldn't laugh, but I mean, it's so ironic, yeah. Isn't it? But look, I mean, can you just address this question, which is also one of those knotty issues, which doesn't really ever get properly looked at in the mainstream press here in the UK, which is this kind of almost conflagration of Jewish ethnicity and Jewish faith, because the two seem to be kind of wrapped into one. Actually, there are many secular Jews.
Yes, indeed. Yes, I mean, many Jews will retain some identity as Jews for cultural and other reasons, but they're not religious. The majority of Jews, in fact, are not religious. But Zionism, as I say, was never a religious movement. It was a political movement which adopted the form, the clothes, if you like, a religion. It's not unusual. Lots of political movements have taken the political form.
Well, look,
fascism, a religious
just
form.
A minute, Tony, because the Zionists say that God gave us this land. How can it not be a religious movement?
Well, the founder of political Zionism was a guy called Theodor Herzl. He was the first president of the World Zionist Congress. His son, Hans, was not even circumcised. That's usually considered essential for someone who's belonging to the Jewish faith. He, in his pamphlet, the first founding pamphlet called The Jewish State, he suggests colonization either in Argentina or Palestine. He didn't really care which. It was only because Palestine had a greater resonance amongst Jews. They decided that they would focus on Palestine, but there was nothing inevitable about it. I mean, Herzl, above all, was a supporter of imperialism and colonization. So that was the main project of Zionism. But it adopted the language and the symbols of the Jewish religion in order to try to appeal to other Jews. But most Jews were not convinced. The most vehement opponents of Zionism when it arose were the Orthodox Jews, who said this is sacrilegious. We've been exiled by God as punishment for our sins, and when the Messiah comes, then he will take us back to Palestine. Zionism is really a form of idolatry, worship of land. That's their obsession. It is not a religious movement. That's absolutely clear. They take from the Bible what they want and disregard the rest. So, you know, and I can give you lengthy quotations as to why they take certain parts of the Bible and not others. Zionism was never, ever a religious movement. It was, I say, fiercely opposed by almost unanimously Orthodox jury.
One of the craziest things, sorry Tony, one of the craziest things about the Zionist movement is it echoes something which happened hundreds of years ago in the Crusades, where there was this attempt by European powers, European leaders, and particularly spurred on by the Knights Templar, who were basically part of the Roman Catholic Church, that didn't have to obey the law. They were bankers, etc., but they were also fierce knights. And they did something similar. They tried to do something similar hundreds of years ago. That is to set up, the King of Jerusalem, take over the Holy Land. Some have pointed to what's been going on since the Second World War over in Israel as almost echoing the Crusades from hundreds of years ago.
Well, you can make the analogy, but of course it was a completely different context of, if you like, the Roman Catholic powers in Europe trying to, if you like, colonize Palestine. But the irony is, of course, that whenever the Crusades set off and wherever they went, they slaughtered Jews. And in fact, the Jews of Palestine, who were under attack by the Crusaders, formed an alliance and sought the protection of Saladin, who was the leader of the Muslims. So this idea that somehow there is Zionist colonization and the Crusaders and the Christians are as one doesn't really hold water. I mean, yes, the Crusades were a form of colonization of Palestine, but that had nothing to do with Zionism. Say at the time, the Jews were slaughtered by the Crusaders when they went.
Well, I also point out that in Constantinople, the Orthodox Christians were also slaughtered by these wonderful Crusaders. I suppose they hoped.
Absolutely, that... yes. It wasn't a religious movement. It too was a political movement aimed at capturing vast quantities of booty and gold and wealth and so on. I mean, we have to understand it politically, not religiously. There was no religious imperative for the Crusaders, but politically, of course, there was.
Okay, so what about, you mentioned Herzl and the first Zionist Congress. Now, this has carried on, I think, isn't it, every 4 years or something, there's another Zionist Congress. How has this progressed through the decades since the late 1800s?
Oh, well, I don't know what number we're up to now, to be quite honest, but the first Zionist Congress was in Basel in Switzerland in 1897. It's quite an interesting story because it tells you something about the Jewish reception for the Zionists. The first Zionist Congress was meant to be in Munich, but when the Jews in Munich and the rabbis there heard the Zionists were coming, they petitioned the local government and said, why are they coming? This is a form of anti-Semitism. We don't want them here. And so they had to move to Switzerland to hold their first Congress.
It sounds like the Zionists petitioning to stop you coming to do a talk, Tony.
Well, except the Jews at that time had a good reason, because the Zionists were echoing everything the anti-Semites said. The anti-Semites said, you don't belong, you're a separate nation or race. And the Zionists said, yes, we are, we take pride in it. And for most Jews, the Zionists were undividing their hard-won rights. I mean, 1871 in Germany was when they were emancipated. It was about 1856 in Britain. So emancipation was still very new in some countries. It hadn't taken place. And what the Zionists were saying simply echoed what the anti-Semites were saying. So most Jews saw Zionism as a form of Jewish anti-Semitism. And actually, even today, in reality, that is exactly what it is. It has very little to do with religion. It's a racial phenomenon, a racial movement.
Okay, so what about the more modern versions of this World Zionist Congress? I imagine you've got people like Netanyahu bowling up at these now.
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, they're held once every 5 years, and they're held in Israel. The 2015 Congress, World Zionist Congress in Jerusalem, Netanyahu gave the speech as Prime Minister, and he explained that the reason for the Holocaust, that Hitler had met the leader of the Palestinians, which the British had appointed, the Palestinians had the Mufti, and it was only then he was converted to the idea, not of expelling the Jews, but of burning them instead. And it was the Palestinians who converted him to this, because they met in November 1941. In fact, the Holocaust had already started back in June with the invasion of Russia, but this was complete nonsense. But Netanyahu deliberately was trying to exonerate Hitler and put the blame on the Palestinians, because for the Zionists, the Holocaust was only useful insofar as it bolsters their own state.
Well, look, that brings us perfectly on to this new book of yours, Zionism During the Holocaust, The Weaponization of Memory in the Service of State and Nation, Tony. Can you tell us why you thought this was a useful, important book to write? Because it's quite big, isn't it? I think, isn't it, about it's like 500 pages or so?
Yes, I'm sorry about that, but yes, it's over 500 pages and there's over 3,000 footnotes. The reason I wrote it, because, you know, some people are not in the habit of telling the truth. The Zionists justify what they're doing in Israel. their colonization, their apartheid racial state. They justify it using the Holocaust, the death of 6 million Jews. And if you, today, every Holocaust organization is a Zionist organization. So the Holocaust has been used deliberately in order to reinforce the position ideologically of Israel. The idea that Israel is some kind of penance for what happened in Europe in the 1930s and 40s. And so I thought it was useful to actually give a history of actually what did happen during the Holocaust, which was the Zionists didn't want to know.
Look, before we get into that, can I just ask you about this word Holocaust? Because one of the things that annoys me is that during the days of the Spanish and the British Empire and the colonization of the Americas, if you look at some of the, there were all sorts of varying numbers of accounts of the numbers of Native Americans who were slaughtered by Europeans, during the 14 and 1500s, and, mostly the 1500s. And an enormous amount of killing went on over there. Some estimates as high as 100 or 110 million Native Americans killed. This to me should sort of, that definitely counts as a Holocaust in my book.
Absolutely,
told the word Holocaust really just refers to what happened to the sort of rabbinic Jewish community in Nazi-occupied Europe.
Well, this is another theme of the way that the Zionists have distorted history. They claim that the Holocaust was simply about the Jews and no one else. And in fact, in one of the books by Zionist historian Lucy Davidovits, it's called The War Against the Jews. In other words, everything Hitler did had one particular aim, which is extermination of the Jews. I mean, this is a kind of fairy story in a way. I mean, Hitler came to power actually not because of anti-Semitism. He played it down before 1933. He came to power on an anti-communist platform, and that was supported by British leaders, Lloyd George, Churchill. They all welcomed him because they thought he was, he would destroy the German working class organizations, the trade unions and the Communist Party and so on, which of course he did. And the first concentration camp, Dachau, it wasn't for Jews. It was for German trade unionists, socialists, communists and so on. So you have to understand the Holocaust did not start with an obsession with Jews. Of course, Hitler was anti-Semitic, that goes without saying. But in Europe, I mean, Hitler didn't just confine his attentions to the Jews. An equal proportion of gypsies were exterminated. But no one hears about that now. The Holocaust, in many ways, started with the murder of the disabled. In Germany itself, German disabled people, Jewish and non-Jewish, were murdered from 1939-1940 onwards, until it was officially a stop was put to it in 1941 when the Catholic and Protestant churches spoke out. Although in reality, it continued throughout the war. The idea that someone who was disabled wasn't a fit member of the race and they should be eliminated to make the race purified and better and increase the blood stock, that was called eugenicism, kind of selective breeding and so on. But I mean, the Holocaust should not and is not just a Jewish affair. I mean, Hitler and Himmler spoke quite openly of exterminating 30 million Russians in order to provide food for the Germans.
I suppose, the way to start, I think, looking at this is got to be Hitler's coming to power in the early 1930s. And, of course, was at the time and already quite big German Zionist Federation. So what happened at that point?
Well, let me correct you on that. The German Zionist Federation was not big. Zionism was a fringe minority amongst German Jews in 1933. Something like 2% of the German Jews were Zionists. But they were, if you like, the only German Jews who welcomed the ascent of Hitler. In fact, the Zionist movement as a whole, the leadership saw in the ascent of Hitler their salvation. They saw that it would be good for them.
Germans, to be fair, a lot of Germans did welcome the ascent of Hitler because the country was in such a terrible state.
Well, I mean, it's true that some Germans did, but in fact, in the last free elections in November 1932, The vote for the Nazis dropped by 2 million. The communists and the socialists got more votes, 13 million, as opposed to about 11.5 million for the Nazis. So, in fact, more Germans supported, if you like, the left than the right. And it was at that point that the military and the conservative parties, represented by von Papen, put Hitler in power in order to destroy the left and the communists and the trade unionists. That's the real history, and that was welcomed by Western leaders. I mean, Roosevelt's administration talked of Hitler being a moderate, but the reaction to that amongst Jews worldwide was one of absolute horror at the ascent of Hitler, because they realised what may happen. They immediately launched a boycott. A boycott of Nazi Germany was a massive movement in 1933, but it was opposed by the Zionist movement and, if you like, the capitalist or bourgeois Jews for their own economic reasons.
Now, this is interesting, particularly because it was the reason why the former Labour Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, was expelled from the Labour Party for actually spelling this out. And yet, as you've just said there, this is simply a historical fact. So can you just go into that a bit more? Because I think many people who have voted for Ken in London over the years are rather annoyed that the Labour Party expelled him for simply stating historical facts.
Well, let me correct you again. He didn't actually get expelled. He was, in the end, he resigned. But he was suspended, yes, because this was held to be a terrible anti-Semitic crime, mentioning what was a historical fact, which was Havara, the trade agreement between the Zionists and the Nazis. And it arose quite simply. I say, when Hitler came to power in March 33 in the unfree elections, Jews reacted by launching an international boycott, and they were supported by socialists and communists and the labour movement and many, many other people, like the Roman Catholic Bishop of Liverpool, for example. The only section of Jews who opposed the boycott were the Zionists, because they wanted to trade with Hitler. And in fact, between 1933 and 1939, of total capital investment in Jewish Palestine, the Jewish Palestinian economy, 60% came from Nazi Germany. So the Zionists quite deliberately opposed the boycott from the start. And in August 1933, they reached their own trade agreement, which is widely condemned, massively condemned amongst the Jews. They were seen as scabs, basically.
Okay, black. I wonder what the Nazis obviously got some trade, the Zionists got some trade, and I imagine that the Jewish Boycott Committee in the United States, which I think it was where it was mainly based, were really annoyed that they'd broken it. But what was this agreement? What was the quid pro quo for agreeing to trade with the Nazis?
Oh, well, for the Zionists, it was quite simple. They were saving what they called the wealth of the German Jewish community, which is a prosperous Jewish community. They wanted to lay their hands on the wealth of that community in order to expand the economy of Palestine, which they did. To the Germans, it was a minor matter. I mean, trade with Palestine was insignificant for them in terms of the total German economy. But the very useful nature of Havara for them was it undermined the boycott, which they really did fear. The boycott was cutting their foreign trade enormously. 50%, it was going down. And without export, the German economy simply could not survive. So to the Nazis,
how did Jews react to this, where the Zionists had come in and said, well, never mind the boycott, we're going to trade with them anyway?
With absolute horror. I mean, a Jewish Chronicle, which was a pro-Zionist paper at that time, called it the unclean thing. They vehemently opposed it. The vast majority of Jews. There was a 50,000 demonstration in 1933 by Jews in London against the Nazis and in favour of boycott. The Zionists were a tiny minority. They didn't control anything then, but they formed an alliance with the bourgeois Jews and the Board of Deputies in order to oppose the boycott. The Board of Deputies, when it came to fighting Hitler, were absolute pussies. They were a pushover, and the Zionists weren't even interested in opposing Hitler. They wanted to take advantage of the Nazi movement in order to build the Jewish Palestine. And that's what they were about. They about building their own racial state, mirroring in many ways what was happening in Nazi Germany at that time, which was racial separation. It wasn't, although there were killings, Jews weren't being murdered in their thousands as would happen, and millions as would happen later.
I mean, but you might say the Zionists were doing a good job in a way, because what they were doing was helping to sort of cut deals with the Nazis to try and help some Jews at least get out of the country before being arrested, persecuted, camps and this sort of thing, and get away to Palestine, for example.
No, not at all. Haverhoff was not about helping Jews to escape. It was about laying your hands on the wealthy German Jews. Haverah was only for rich Jews. You could only take advantage of Haverah if you had £1,000 in cash, which the Nazis would let you out with, in order to obtain entrance to Palestine. Because anyone with £1,000, which is now worth £60,000-£70,000, was considered a capitalist and was given free entry. They didn't need an immigration certificate. So it only applied to a minority of German Jews, about 20,000. But those 20,000 would have gained entry anywhere in the world. The problem was the Zionists lobbied the Gestapo to only allow Jews to leave if they went to Palestine. So Haverah actually inhibited the saving of German Jews. It didn't help them in any way whatsoever. I mean, Livingston touched on it, and he was penalised, actually, to be quite honest. When he was suspended and he came up before the disciplinary in the Labour Party, they did not want to go anywhere near the question of Haverah. He was accused of bringing the Labour Party into disrepute and all the other flotsam and jetsam allegations, but they would not actually tackle the question of Haverah themselves because they knew they were on pretty shaky ground.
I think he was mugged. One of the sections in your book, it touches on some very controversial ideas, and that is comparing Zionism to Nazism. And this, I mean, surely this is almost a kind of step too far. The Nazis were not actually Zionists, were they?
Well, no, I mean, the Nazis weren't Zionists. I mean, they were pro-Zionists in the same way that you have today Christian Zionists. I mean, they weren't Jewish Zionists, but a large section, the Gestapo and the SS especially, were very vehemently pro-Zionists. Because the Zionists, they saw as the good Jews, whereas most Jews were bad Jews. So, yes, they formed an alliance, and the Gestapo banned all anti-Zionist and non-Zionist German Jewish organizations from meeting from 1936. But they accepted the Zionists who could meet and organize up till 1939. They were forever being, if you like, favored as the good racial Jews. That's, I mean, the only section of German Jewry which welcomed the Nuremberg laws were the Zionist movement in Germany, because there was nothing they could really disagree with. It simply separated Germans from Jews. They saw that as a good thing, not a bad thing, but it's simply not true to say that Zionism ever opposed the Nazis. But in terms of comparisons, let me just say this. If you can't compare particular historical phenomena, then you don't have a history. I mean, the only way you can understand history is by making comparisons, because that's kind of translation into the present. Of course, comparing something doesn't mean they're the same. I'm not saying that Nazism and Zionism were the same, because they weren't. Obviously, Nazism was a German fascist movement. Zionism was a form of settled colonialism. So in that sense, they were different. And the Zionist movement at that stage was a Jewish movement. So there is no identity, if you like. They're not equal, but certainly there are comparisons. They both had a racial conception of Jews. They saw Jews as a separate race. The Nazis said they didn't want Jews in Germany, and the Zionists said, yes, we agree. That was the basis. But they had a racial, not a class conception of Jews. But today you can make the comparison. I mean, when mobs of Jewish settlers in Jerusalem march through the Arab area chanting death to the Arabs, what does that remind you? Mobs of Germans and Poles were marching shouting death to the Jews. I mean, there is no difference. Or when in Israel, you cannot live in certain areas, the majority of the country, in fact, if you're an Arab. Well, the same is true in Nazi Germany. laws were introduced to prevent Jews living except in Jewish areas. There weren't ghettos, but there were Jewish areas.
But there was a stage, wasn't there, during World War II, where the Nazis really stepped up their persecution and incarceration of Jews. And this is around about the summer-autumn time in 1941. Can you just tell us what was going on there and why they suddenly started, why you think they suddenly started to focus on, right, we've really got to get these Jews out of the way quickly?
Well, in 1941, the invasion of Russia, Operation Barbarossa, it marks the start of the Holocaust. What that meant, well, with Hitler's invasion of Poland, I mean, it began even early in one sense, was German colonization. I mean, Eastern Europe was to Germany like India was to Britain. It was the main area and focus of their activity. And by focusing on the Jews, they actually welded German nationalism together. In many ways, German nationalism of the Nazi variety was focused on the non-Aryan, the element that didn't fit into German society. And that included Jews, Gypsies, and black people, and so on. It wasn't just
particularly
Jews.
Didn't like the Slavs, did they?
No, the Slavs were seen as slave nations who weren't on the same racial ladder, if you like, as the Germans. I mean, they did debate at one point whether they would actually wipe out the Poles. And in fact, from 1939 to 1941, Operation, I think it was Tannenberg it was called, was aimed at wiping out the Polish intelligentsia, because a slave nation does not need people who think or create or write. And in fact, more Jews died because they were members of the Polish intelligentsia than because they were Jews in that period from 1939 to 1941. Of course, with the invasion of Russia, that anti-Semitism became lethal. It became exterminatory, as it did for the Gypsies, as it did for homosexuals, as it did for many others. So, I mean, to claim the Holocaust again as simply a Jewish affair is an example of Zionist exclusivism, nationalism, chauvinism, if you like, because it simply does not hold water. The Holocaust wasn't just a Jewish affair. Of course, Jews suffered, as did many, many others. I mean, millions upon millions of people died. 3-4 million Russian prisoners of war, for example. 3 million Poles died. 6 million Jews died, 0.5 to 1 million Gypsies, and so on. So, you know, I mean, that's what Nazism is.
And it all stepped up. The Nazis stepped things up. As they maybe after Stalingrad, or around about the time of Stalingrad, started getting even more worried about that they might lose the war, I suppose, then they were doubling down on their efforts. But anyhow, another important stage was the Wannsee Conference. Wannsee Conference in January 1942, I think it was.
Yes,
that's right. Step up in persecution.
Well, it's arguable. It's arguable. The Wannsee Conference was postponed from November 1941 because of the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor. So it's postponed to January 42. But it was a one-day affair. They discussed mainly the Mischlinge, which were the mixed German-Jewish race, if you like. It was the Jews who'd married out and they were half Jewish or three quarters of Jewish. They were more concerned with that than the Holocaust per se. But it's a misnomer to say that Wannsee introduced the Holocaust. The Holocaust has already been going on in Russia and Eastern Europe since the previous June. And in fact, the first concentration, the extermination camp rather, which had been opened, was opened before Wannsee. That's his Chelmno, and Belzec was under construction before then. So, and Auschwitz had been going, and it was changing from a labor camp to an extermination camp. So it's simply not true. In my opinion, it's just my opinion, Wannsee was more about extending the Holocaust to Western Europe from Eastern Europe. It wasn't about initiating the Holocaust. In fact, one German historian called it a luncheon party, and that people are still wondering why it was held. So it wasn't as crucial as it is now maintained.
Tension, Tony, about what really went on, not just with Jews, but with all prisoners in the labour camps, in that some say, I mean, the more extreme, shall we say, lunatic fringe, talk about them as holiday camps, and I find this rather irritating. But quite obviously they were labour camps. The idea was we incarcerate people and we get them to work. I think the SS paid something like 1 or 2 marks a day for every worker. So the prison guards and the SS are being paid by these big industries for these workers who are incarcerated. Now, what incentive is there really on the Nazi war machine to exterminate Jews when instead, and other prisoners, when instead actually they could just get them to work for next to nothing towards the war effort?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, the extermination of Jews and others as part of the Nazi racial project in many ways did not make any economic sense. But so it's a question of when ideas obtain, if you like, a material reality. But the Nazis were exterminating Jews and others, even though economically it made very little sense. But as the war wore on, of course, and more Germans were killed, the Nazis came to rely often on Jewish labour. In fact, they imported 80 to 100,000 Jews back into the Reich at the end of the war because they had no one else to work. They did that with Poles, of course, and French people and all sorts of other people became slave labour in a sense. And that's what the Nazis relied on. But it was a primitive form of capitalism in a sense, which is what slavery is. But the conditions in the labor camps were certainly not holiday camps. I mean, those who say that really know nothing about it.
Can we just touch on the knotty issue of Alfred Rosenberg? Because he was one of the main ideologues in the late 20s of the National Socialism and early
30s. Yes.
And yet, apparently, if you look at most of the history books, they say, well, he wasn't Jewish.
Well, that's right. He was Estonian. He wasn't Jewish, although he had a Jewish-sounding name. That doesn't necessarily imply he was Jewish. He was the leader. He was the commissar, general, as it were, in the East for the Eastern Territories. And he had, you know, an extremely bloody record. I mean, millions died under his rule, and he was hanged at Nuremberg, and quite rightly so. But he was ardently pro-Zionist from the very start. He said what the Zionists are saying completely chimes in with what we're saying, and we will use it to deprive the Jews of all their legal rights. But yes, Rosenberg wasn't Jewish. He was a Satanist, if anything. He was very anti-Christian. He was the main theoretician for the Nazi Party. He wrote a book, The Myth of the 20th Century, which was a kind of Nazi Bible in a sense. Although Hitler wasn't overstruck with him, but that was internal. He thought he went too far, but he represented quite a large element in Nazi anti-Christianity.
Well, there are other elements in Nazism, you know, such as the veneration of Nietzsche. You know, there are some of these, I mean, for example, now, which have been kind of rehabilitated. Some even say that eugenics is having a comeback. I wonder if, you know, there are still elements of this Nazi ideology which have been lingering around in the background, which are coming and may come to the fore again. I mean, Nietzsche, for example, if you go to most philosophy departments of any university in the world, you know, considered to be, you know, almost like the pinnacle of philosophy.
Nietzsche, I think, what the survival of the fittest. I mean, I'm no expert in, but it's a mistake to think that Nazism simply sprung out of nowhere. I mean, if you read Mein Kampf, Hitler paid tribute to the Americans for their eugenic movement. Many states in the United States banned sexual intercourse and called it miscegenation between black and white people. They outlawed that. They forcibly sterilized what they called enfeebled women, for example. Eugenicism started in America, in the United States. It extended to, I mean, Sweden was an ardent proponent of it. Hitler didn't simply arise out of nothing. On the contrary, I mean, the British during the war, even the foreign ministry, the Ministry of Information, wanted to give to Africans leaflets condemning Hitler for his racial policies, and the ministry, the colonial and the foreign office at that time stepped in and said no. What they will say is that we're just as bad as them. We can't do this. So they scrapped the idea. And that is the irony. I mean, Hitler praised the British Empire because he saw it as a model. And in that sense, he was right. The British Empire had slaughtered millions of people as well. During the war, there was a famine caused by the British in Bengal. 3 million people died. That was under Hitler, under Churchill's tutelage. Why he saw the Indians as rather a beastly people, as he put it, and he was quite content to export wheat and rice and so on out of India at the very same time that people were literally dying. So the Allies didn't go to war for anti-fascist reasons. They went to war because they were imperialist rivals.
One of the chapters in your book is entitled When and What Did They Know? I love this title, Tony, because I think sometimes these things are kept hidden at certain points and then they emerge. So, I mean, particularly with things like the British and the Americans fighting the Nazis, and particularly the German domestic population, how much did they know about what was going on in these concentration camps?
What, the British or the Americans?
I suppose both, really. And when, answer your own question. When and what did they do?
Well, I pose the question. I don't provide any final answers to it. I think people have to look for themselves. But from all the information, the work of Richard Brightman in particular, there is no doubt the British intelligence knew SIGINT, what's now called GCHQ. They broke into the codes and the messages between the concentration camps and the extermination camps. So they knew about Auschwitz and what was happening extremely early on, but they didn't let it go any further. The reality was the British imperialists and the Americans, Roosevelt, they really didn't want to know. They were fighting Germany, not for anti-fascist or anti-racist reasons, but because they saw Hitler as a threat to their own interests.
Because they also saw, surely the leadership in the West during World War II had to be quite careful, didn't they? Because they were kind of playing God. They didn't want the Nazis to know that they were able to listen into their communications and that they figured these things out.
To some extent, but there were ways and means of getting this information across. To be quite honest, they didn't care. At one point, I quote the Foreign Office as having a fear. In fact, it was Anthony Eden who expressed his fears to the Americans that Hitler, instead of exterminating the Jews, might turn once again to extruding them, in other words, to expelling them. And that was a great fear. What would they do with all these millions of Jews? In essence, their immigration policies were devised knowing full well what was happening to the Jews. The British knew, and they should have released that information. I mean, the SS weren't stupid. In the end, they actually stopped the communications between the camps and relied more on physical messengers and so on,
okay, because they knew what was happening. The population themselves, though, how much did they know?
I think they knew very little. Look, I mean, what happened in 1939, 1940, I think it was October 39 when it began, was the so-called euthanasia campaign, when Hitler gave the order that anyone who was mentally or physically handicapped would go into one of six killing centres, Hadamar and so on, Brandenburg, and they would literally die from poison gas. That was where the idea of killing people off en masse with gas arose. It was in the killing centres. And that was not Jews particularly, although Jews were singled out. It was the children of Germans themselves. Anyone who had a child who was disabled or autistic or had a physical deformity, they were taken away. They were put in these so-called hospitals, and they were killed off. The doctor spent all day forging death certificates. That was, it's quite ironic. They were killed in these gas trucks where the carbon monoxide from the exhaust was piped inside of the trucks, and the people died inside it, died as a result. And that, a very horrible death. I mean, although Hitler called it a merciful death, it was anything but that. And, you know, I mean, half of these people were children, young, little children. And this caused an uproar in Germany when it was revealed. I mean, you know, I mean, the news got out because these death certificates kept arriving back. Anyone who had a child who was disabled was to find they had been killed off. And in 1941, Bishop Garland of Munster, in a very widely publicised sermon, condemned what was happening and demanded an end to it. In fact, it was the Protestant Pastor Braun who was the initiator of this, but history gets rewritten in so many ways. And there was an uproar in Germany, you know, and Hitler was forced to back off. I mean, the Nazis, some of them proposed hanging Bishop Garland as an example, but they realised their regime wouldn't survive. If they did that, there would be mass revolt. So the Nazis determined that the extermination camps would not be situated in Germany because they feared a similar revolt. So they were situated in Poland. That's where it happened. So, and they did that because they didn't want people to know. It was a state secret, the idea of the exterminations. Even Hitler's successor, what was it, Admiral Dönitz, he said, testified at the Nuremberg trials, but he knew nothing whatsoever. Even senior Nazis said, I mean, it was a very, very closely kept secret, even from within the SS.
And also, one of the interesting things is there were revolts within these concentration and death camps, like particularly at Treblinka and Sobibor.
That's right.
So this actually did take place, didn't it? And there was some active resistance.
Yes, indeed. Both at Sobibor and Treblinka, there were major revolts. They were led by military officers, ex-military officers.
And actually, you know, resulted in, I think you say in the book, something like 60 or 70 people managed to escape and survive the war, which is quite incredible.
It is. I mean, but you have to put it in context. In Treblinka, something like 800,000 Jews were exterminated. It wasn't a labour camp unlike Auschwitz. So very, very few Jews survived otherwise. Chelmno, I think, 3 or 4 Jews survived out of about 400,000. Belzec, a similar number, you know, a secret camp which killed 400,000 to 600,000 Jews. I mean, you know, I mean, literally they were disappearing. The Jews of Warsaw were killed in Treblinka, for example. The Jews of Lodz were killed in Chelmno. So, I mean, these camps absorbed literally millions, but yes, there were revolts. They weren't entirely successful. I mean, the odds were obviously against them, but they did kill a number of SS, and a few hundred people did escape, and some survived till the end of the war. But that was an example. I mean, the Zionists today pour scorn on the people who died and said they didn't fight back, but that's simply a lie. They fought back whenever they could, and the Warsaw Ghetto, which the Zionists told their own comrades, don't participate in it, come to Palestine, it's the Arabs your main enemy, not the Germans. And to their credit, people like Heike Klinger refused. They said, we're going to die with our people. If the people must die, then the leadership will die. So, I mean, the young Zionists who fought in the Warsaw Ghetto fought there despite the fact they were Zionists. It wasn't because of Zionism. Zionism was always a quisling movement. It never fought fascism. And today, I mean, it takes on the appearance of fascism in so many ways.
I mean, one of the most shocking things is this thing you talk about, the Judenrata, I think that's how you pronounce it, which was nearly everywhere. Apparently, the Nazis conquered throughout Nazi-occupied Europe. They established these Judenrata who were Zionists, basically, of different factions of Zionism, you say. Now, they were actually there to communicate the Nazis' orders to the Jewish population. Now, I didn't know they had this extent of collaboration with, you know, Jews basically telling other Jews what to do, just giving them the orders straight from the top.
Yes, whenever the Nazis conquered Jewish communities in Eastern Europe, with the exception of Operation Barbarossa, where they simply sent killing squads in. They established ghettos and they appointed a Jewish council called the Judenrat. It was composed of the traditional Jewish leadership. About two-thirds of them were Zionists, not all of them were Zionists. Some were just simply bourgeois Jews of whatever description. But say the majority of the leadership was Zionist. And they did the work of the Nazis for them. They rounded up the Jews. They concentrated them. They misinformed them. And in Warsaw and other places, they actually single-handedly searched out Jews from perfectly good hiding places and did the work of the Nazis. And the Judenrat were hated by the Jews of the ghettos. The Zionists today have tried to rehabilitate them. And it's not surprising because, I mean, the Zionist movement was a collaborationist movement. It was a quisling movement. It never fought Nazism. It ate to their methods and ideology. But that's, of course, anti-Semitic today. You mustn't mention facts because it might upset certain people, but it's true. And Isaiah Trunk wrote an exhaustive study of the Judenrat, 800 pages. He was an ardent pro-Zionist, incidentally, but he did a survey of those who survived, and he found that something like 2 out of 3 of the leaders of these councils were Zionists. So it wasn't surprising. I mean, the Zionists were not working class in Eastern Europe. They came from the bourgeois, the petty bourgeois Jews.
Even establishing what you call in the book a Jewish police force.
Oh, yes, of course. They had to have some means of controlling the Jews of the ghettos, and they established, with Nazi support, and they were armed with batons and so on, a Jewish police force, and they were comprised usually revisionist Zionists, right-wing Zionists, but also some Labour Zionists as well, but they were meant to keep control. So, yes, I mean, the Judenrat, with very few exceptions, undermine the Jewish will to resist in the ghetto. I mean, the famous example was in Vilna, where Jacob Gens basically demanded the head of the leader of the resistance, or otherwise the Nazis would be set on the whole camp of the whole city. In the end, of course, the Nazis rounded up the Jews of Vilna, which was the capital of Lithuania, and deported them 2 weeks after this. But they killed the communist leader of the Jewish resistance, Yitzhak Wittenberg, as a result. And again, I mean, the Zionists in the resistance put a lot of pressure on for him to surrender, which was an appalling thing. He was a communist Jew. He was a communist everywhere who led the resistance and the Bund in Poland. So the Zionists really provided very little. I mean, there were some young Zionists who fought in the resistance, not because they were Zionists, but despite the fact they were Zionists, the authorities in Palestine really deprecated Jewish involvement in the resistance because they saw them as being slaughtered as a result. So
Now, when it came to the end of the Second World War, I can even remember as a youngster my uncle telling me, you know, what he discovered as a soldier in the infantry being one of the most horrific sights he'd ever seen. And he said the only saving grace was that he and his fellow soldiers realised that they had been on the right side during that war, and that they'd been actually trying to exterminate something which was very deeply evil. And he came across, and many, of course, others came across, was these camps with a mixture of kind of people who were sick and dying, and still some who were being used for labour. So this must have been a pretty horrific sight for that generation of soldiers. And I suppose, you know, the intelligence people, filmmakers, cameramen, to come across these camps at the time.
Well, the British liberated Belsen-Bergen, and that was in a horrific state. Belsen-Bergen had actually been one of the best concentration camps because it was an exchange camp where the Germans put Jews in order to exchange them with Germans who were living in Allied countries. But as the war wore on, conditions became worse, and at the end it had no food. They appointed Franz Stangl, who was a particularly horrific commander. And when the British entered, there were thousands of people just dying of starvation and typhus and so on. That's where Anne Frank died, for example. But Belsen originally had been a model exchange camp. It was one of the best camps, not the worst. But when the British came, they saw it in all its horror. But, I mean, other camps in Mauthausen and Austria were far worse, which the Americans liberated. And, of course, Auschwitz and others in the east, which the Russians liberated, were far, far worse. Belsen didn't have any gas chambers, for example, unlike Auschwitz and Mauthausen and others. So, but yes, I mean... yes, of course, when British soldiers came in for the first time, then they would have been absolutely horrified. But of course, the British were the first people to establish concentration camps in South Africa. And the Nazis established an extermination camp on, I think it was called Snake Island, in Namibia, where in fact the first idea of exterminating people arose. In fact, the person, Eugen Fischer, who ran that camp, later trained the Nazi SS doctors, including Mengele, who was the chief SS doctor at Auschwitz. So there was a straight line between German imperialism in Africa and what happened in Europe. And the British also are not absolved of this. And in fact, they, in Kenya in the 50s, they recreated a concentration camp. So
now, also, I mean, after the war, the creation of the State of Israel through the vote of the new United Nations, that was quite contentious in itself. It was a very hard won vote. But you then, I mean, although the book is called Zionism During the Holocaust, you then go on to look at the way that the Zionists used the Holocaust in the initial stages of the creation of the Israeli state. So you've got a section, for example, the Holocaust and the creation of Israel's foundational myths. So what are those myths?
Well, there were a lot of myths. I mean, the first myth is that Israel was an answer to the Holocaust. It never was an answer. The Zionist movement during the war undermined any attempt to rescue Jews fleeing from Nazi occupation if their destination wasn't Palestine. So, I mean, for example, there was an attempt to actually channel Jewish refugees to Alaska. Because Alaska was the only part of the United States that wasn't subject to the immigration laws because they wanted it colonized. It's not the most, if you like, alluring part of the United States. So they were happy even for Jews coming from Europe to go there. But what did the leader of the American Zionists say? Oh, no, it wasn't suitable for Jews because it was too cold there. You know, presumably Auschwitz is a bit warmer.
No, I think you're being a bit rough and tough there because the Zionists did provide, almost a kind of conveyor belt if Jews wanted to escape Germany to Palestine, didn't they? I mean, that's why they're so...
No. Absolutely not. The Zionists organized their own Aliyah Bet, which was the illegal immigration of Jews to Palestine during the war. It saved maybe 6,000-8,000 people. But they were only the Zionist Chalutzim, the pioneers, the young, fit colonizers. They didn't want the old, they didn't want the aged, they didn't want the disabled, they didn't want the Jewish trader, they didn't want the average Jew. They simply wanted the aspiring colonist. For all the rest of the Jews, they actively fought to close off any avenue of escape which wasn't Palestine. The logic of Zionism was that the reason for anti-Semitism in the diaspora was the presence of Jews in other people's countries. They compared them to guests in a hotel who outstayed their welcome. And they said, well, transplanting Jews to Argentina or to America or anywhere else would simply recreate anti-Semitism and wouldn't solve the problem. We want to solve the problem. We don't want to set up Jewish settlement in other places. So they opposed it. They opposed all these rescue attempts. The result is that hundreds of thousands of Jews who could have survived died as a result of the Zionist effort. So I give evidence in my book where the leader of the Board of Deputies, Selig Brzezinski, deliberately and openly sabotaged the efforts of the Chief Rabbi's Rescue Committee, led by Dr. Solomon Schonfield, who was busily trying to get Parliament to agree to admit any Jewish refugee who managed to land on these shores. He was a Zionist who openly sabotaged it. I mean, there's no dispute about this. Schonfield wrote in 1943 of how Brodetsky had sabotaged his efforts. And Brodetsky replied 2 weeks later saying, yes, I did, because he had no authority. Only the Board of Deputies has the right to speak to the British government. He was more concerned about his own pomp and prestige than the fact that people were burning Auschwitz at the time. And he was a completely despicable man. And this correspondence is in the pages of the Jewish Chronicle, where the chief assistant to Rabbi Schonfield pointed out everything that Brodetsky had done. And say Brodetsky didn't even deny it. He was quite proud of what he'd done. So, I mean, yes, everywhere the Zionists were a hindrance to the efforts to save Jews. I mean, that's the truth. They don't talk about this now, of course, and they say that's anti-Semitism. But, you know, I mean, anti-Semitism is a charge that's wielded rather lightly these days anyway, so I don't think we should worry about that.
Okay, any other foundational myths you think that are specific, you know, to selling this whole idea of the state of Israel being the answer to and absolutely the best thing that could possibly have happened after the extermination of Jews by the Nazis?
Well, yeah, I mean, the main justification for Israel today, often for Jews themselves, is Israel is the last refuge. If things become bad, they can always go to Israel. So it's a refuge from anti-Semitism. So my last chapter in my book is on what happened in Argentina between 1976 and 83. A neo-Nazi junta took place, and they killed 3,000 Jews who died under torture. I mean, 30,000 people died in all, so about 10-12% were Jewish, even though Jews were less than 1% of the population.
Because actually the Germans are very big in Argentina, and there was actually quite a lot of Nazis in Argentina during the war.
Yep, that's right.
Many Nazis at the end of the war actually went over to live in Argentina.
Oh, yes, absolutely, yes. I mean, these ideas, they had a weird conspiracy theory of their own, the Andinia conspiracy of Marx, Freud and Einstein. It was self-made, if you like, in Argentina. But the point I'm making is that this junta was extremely anti-Semitic. And did Israel say anything? Not a word. Not a word. Because it was the main military arms supplier to the Argentinian junta. The armed, trained, equipped officers from the Argentinian army, and with the Falklands War with Britain, who was the main supplier of emergency military equipment to the junta? Israel. You know, I mean, Israel never, ever spoke out against the anti-Semitism, the real, genuine neo-Nazi anti-Semitism of that junta. So the idea that Israel is some kind of solution to anti-Semitism in the world is just a pipe dream. On the contrary, Israel increases anti-Semitism. And you know, I mean, there were Jews who applied at the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires during the junta. They were turned down. Why? They were held to be subversive, too left-wing. Israel didn't want to know. So, I mean, that is a reality. If you have persecution of Jews again, don't expect to get a helping hand from Israel, because Israel is probably going to be in a league with the very regime which is oppressing Jews. So these are yet more myths about Israel, which uses, of course, the Holocaust to justify itself. But during the time of the Holocaust, the Zionist state did not want to know. There was only one aim Zionism had during the Holocaust. That was to build a Jewish state after the war. Everything else was subsidiary, including what was actually taking place in Europe at the time.
Well, look, while we're talking about South America, what about this? In the 1960s, we had this dramatic kidnapping and trial and execution of Adolf Eichmann.
Yes. I mean, to understand the Eichmann trial, you have to understand the Kastner trial. I mean, Kastner was the leader of Hungarian Jewry, and when he came to Israel, he started being accused of being a collaborator, and a trial which lasted for over 4 years, he was actually assassinated. Zion got a pretty bad name in terms of what happened during the Holocaust. So the Eichmann trial was aimed at, if you like, creating a new narrative entirely in which Israel was seen as the answer to what the Nazis had done. And it was also the beginning of using the Holocaust, because up to the Eichmann trial, the Holocaust did not play a central part in Israeli ideology. I mean, if anything, the Holocaust survivors were seen as sheep who went to their deaths without actually fighting back. They were seen really as a disgrace in comparison with a new Israeli who would take up weapons to defend themselves in reality to attack the Palestinians. But the Holocaust didn't form a central part. I think in the first Israeli history textbook, out of 200 pages, one was devoted to the Holocaust and 10 to the Napoleonic Wars. So the Holocaust didn't feature in Zionist propaganda at that time.
I don't know if you've looked into this, but I did a bit of research a few years ago and interviewed John Loftus in the States about it. This is all to do with the creation of the State of Israel at the UN, isn't it? 1947, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Nelson Rockefeller had, there was a big scrabble around to make sure that at the newly formed UN, that the votes were gotten in from around the world behind the State of Israel. And Ben Gurion was told by Rockefeller, apparently, look, we've got a lot of business connections with former Nazis, and in order to get this vote through, you're going to have to make a decision, Ben Gurion. You can have a state, or you can have vengeance from the Second World War, but you can't have both. You're going to have to make your mind up. And so there was an agreement made back in literally straight after the Second World War, that if the Zionists wanted a state in Israel, that they would have to shut up about having any vengeance on the Nazis.
I haven't heard that story, but I give examples in my book of how Israel employed some of the worst Nazi war criminals as part of its efforts, if you like, of sabotage and so on. And I give the example of Walter Rauch, who had been to the gas truck, who tried to set up an extermination camp in Tunisia during the war, and has at least 100,000 people, Jews, to his credit, if you like. Israel employed him as an agent, paid him, and sent him off to Ecuador after they had no further use for him. So Israel was never interested in securing justice for ex-Nazis. I mean, the Eichmann trial was a propaganda trial. It was a show trial. Everyone knew Eichmann was guilty, of course, but according to the trial, Eichmann took sole responsibility for the Holocaust, which almost exonerated Hitler and Himmler. It was an absurdity. I mean, it was a show trial. I mean, most of those who testified had never even met the guy. They tried to frame the Mufti as being responsible for the Holocaust, of course. So, I mean, that was a show trial, but it was aimed, if you like, at using the weaponization of the Holocaust, changing the historical narrative about the Holocaust to make the Zionists look good.
Well, I mean, if you want to follow up the story, it's in, I think, John Loftus's book, The Secret War on the Jews, which is quite a good and interesting pulling apart of some of the shenanigans that was been going on behind the scenes in order to try and get the State of Israel created. Actually, another very good book on that is Roland Perry's The Fifth Man. He's an Australian now, but he was an Australian journalist working in Fleet Street during the 1990s, and he did this biography of Victor Rothschild and details his role in making sure that that vote went through at the United Nations. But I suppose
the Americans put very heavy pressure on some of their allies or client regimes like Liberia to vote for the UN partition.
But it's just Nelson Rockefeller, where apparently what Nelson Rockefeller was doing, according to Loftus, was he was making sure that he delivered the entire American vote. So in South America, Central America, etc., all these little countries behind the decision at the UN. But coming back to Eichmann, apparently a lot of very wealthy Jews and other wealthy businessmen around the world were very annoyed about Eichmann being taken over, and they said that this is the last time this is ever never going to happen, you know, because you've made this agreement back in the 1940s not to go after the Nazi war criminals, and now you've broken that, you know. So in a way they were saying, okay, you've executed Eichmann, but this thus far and no further.
I mean, that could be true. I mean, Israel, I give the example in Paraguay where the chief SS, Dr. Mengele, who decided who would die and who would live, had taken refuge. And repeatedly, Nazi hunters asked why Israel wasn't interested in him. And the reason was, I mean, it served no purpose. So, I mean, Israel wasn't interested in securing justice. Yes,
it's fascinating, because we also had Klaus Barbie, the butcher of Lyon. He was just wandering around in Brazil, I think, just advising the government on torture techniques and this kind of thing. And it was quite, you know, amongst the intelligence services around the world, they knew all about this.
Of course, yes. I mean, why should they? I mean, Britain and America did not fight the Nazis for anti-fascist reasons. On the contrary, the Americans employed thousands of ex-Nazis in their own military machines, so they weren't interested. The British weren't interested. No one was interested after the war. Because the methods that the Nazis used weren't dissimilar to those that both America and Britain used in their own empires and their own imperial domination. So there's a lot of hypocrisy involved. They held the major trials in Nuremberg, but the Cold War ensured they lost interest very quickly.
Looking back on all this now, where are we with the Holocaust and the attempts to sort of, I suppose it's almost like a tug of war, Tony, for an interpretation of history, because it does seem as if the establishment has the big guns, the press, the media. In fact, even you didn't find it that easy to get this book published, did you?
Well, yes. I mean, it was difficult to find a publisher precisely because, you know, I mean, the Zionists wage war and any alternative narrative which challenges their own domination of their interpretation of the Holocaust and what it meant. So, yes, I mean, even left publishers, Pluto, Verso and so on, were not very interested in it. So I had to take other means, if you like, to ensure the book got published. Because, yes, I mean, the Zionists have colonized the Holocaust narrative. I mean, they've turned it into their own. You would think the Zionists were the most active element amongst the Jewish population in trying to undo what Hitler did and to get the Jews out of Germany. But if you read my book, you'll find that, in fact, they were simply not interested. They kept denying that there was a Holocaust, even. They wouldn't even admit to it until they were forced. That they wouldn't announce it until November 1942, at least three, probably more months after they actually knew. They actually sat on news of the Holocaust. And even after that, they started denying it. They refused to publicize it. They downplayed efforts at rescue. They sabotaged rescue efforts. I mean, all of this, of course, has been hidden from history. So the purpose of my book is to open up the pages of history to an alternative interpretation.
Isn't it bizarre the way that the Israelis are so dismissive and aggressive towards Iran? I mean, actually what's happened with Iran is the Islamic Republic of Iran is the Muslims, in a way, doing something similar to what the Jews have done, saying, well, we need our own place, we want to rule it, you know, it with our own ideology, and yet there's a great deal of animosity. In fact, even, you know, talk of war, preemptive strikes and this kind of thing between the two countries down in the Middle East. And you've actually got a whole chapter devoted, I'll just read out the title, which I just found really interesting, which is The World Jewish Conspiracy, which of course had a lot of currency under the Nazis and before that, has been replaced by the Global Islamic Conspiracy. How ironic.
Well, it is, yes, indeed. I mean, the main ideological formulation of the anti-Semites was that the Jews conspired in secret to dominate the world. And now we have the equivalent theories about Muslims wanting to take over Europe, the great replacement theory that Muslims are replacing the white races. And many leading Zionists have openly supported this this nonsense racist idea. I don't give particular currency to Iran. I mean, Israel's opposition to Iran is because it sees a rival to its own hegemony in the Middle East. I mean, that's the main reason for its antagonism. It has nothing to do with a nuclear bomb or anything. That's why they undermined the agreement that Obama reached, which would have prevented Iran developing a nuclear weapon. What they fear, of course, is any challenge to their domination of the region, and that's what that accounts for the hostility. But I mean, the Iranian regime in itself, I mean, it is a pretty vile one. I mean, we see all the demonstrations today by women, quite rightly, saying that we don't want this domination of a corrupt clerical caste in Iran any longer. But yes, Israel is the main harbour of anti-Islamic sentiment throughout the world. That's why the leading Islamophobes really love Israel. I mean, people like Geert Wilders in the Netherlands and the far right in Germany, Alternative for Germany, the neo-Nazi party, they all love Israel. I mean, the worst anti-Semites, like Richard Spencer, the neo-Nazi founder of the alt-right, he loves Israel as the ideal ethno-nationalist state. And, you know, I mean, what is there not to love about Israel?
Okay. Let me just revisit this toxic concept of the world Jewish conspiracy, because it does seem that there are a lot of Jews with a lot of power. For example, you look at the Russian oligarchs, for example, which have been sort of pushed into a corner a bit by Putin. And you look at for example, the Ukrainian oligarchs, the people like Viktor Pinchuk, who hardly ever gets a mention, who's one of the most powerful people in Ukraine and was very much involved in orchestrating the 2014 coup. I mean, just generally speaking, if you go over to the United States, you've got a lot of dual Israeli, US Jewish people who are involved in, you know, things like the Project for the New American Century. You know, they're very powerful Jews around the world. So isn't it kind of almost inevitable that people are going to point to Jewish, the Jewish idea, the word, the name, and say, well, actually, these people are working in concert together? It may not be just Jews, but there is surely some sort of justification for people to be looking in that area and pointing the finger, maybe.
No, I mean, in America, I mean, the main bastion of support for Zionism doesn't actually come from Jews. I mean, the Jewish community is becoming very disillusioned with Israel. I mean, 40% of young Jews now term Israel an apartheid state. It's quite a turnaround. The main bastion of support for Zionism in Israel, in America, is the Christian Zionist community, not the Jewish community. And it's often right-wing Christian billionaires like the Mercer family who are one of the main backers of Israel. Hundreds of millions of pounds a year are being raised by fundamentalist communities in America, I mean, not Jewish communities. So it's simply not true. And in Ukraine, I mean, yes, there may be Jewish oligarchs, including one, Kolomoisky, was it, who supported Zelensky? He's also the main funder of the Azov, the neo-Nazi battalion in Ukraine, the very battalion which is anti-Semitic and pro-Nazi. But, I mean, most Ukrainians are not rich. I mean, I think it's totally erroneous to point out Jewish oligarchs and somehow see some conspiracy. I mean, yes, there are some rich Jews, but there are thousands of poor Jews. And, in fact, Ukrainian Jews have been also victims of the anti-Semitism of the American and British allies in the Ukraine. I mean, they point to Zelensky being Jewish. I mean, that's been the main way they've exonerated the neo-Nazis, ironically, because Zelensky has been their supporter. So I don't accept this kind of Jewish conspiracy. I don't think there's any foundation for it. I mean, Jews may be rich in certain places. There may be a disproportionate amount of wealthy Jews, but that doesn't apply to the vast majority of Jews. I mean, it's just like in Britain. I mean, Jews are overrepresented in the House of Commons. But would anyone say it's a Jewish conspiracy? I doubt it.
What about the recent revelations within the Labour Party, Tony? And this is mainly being, well, I mean, those revelations have been coming out over the last 2 years. There's also, of course, this thing called the Ford Report, which has really examined much going on in the Labour Party, including the use of anti-Semitism to get rid of Labour members such as Ken Livingstone. But most recently, we've had this series on Al Jazeera, the Labour Files, which has really exposed what is absolutely most definitely you know, serious, vile racism going on within the Labour Party.
Absolutely, yes.
Many people actually join the Labour Party because they're anti-racist, and the Labour Party sells itself almost like a sort of, on an advertising marketing stall, as anti-racist, and yet there you've got all the evidence of vile racism going on within the party to target, say, for example, West Indian members, Asian members, saying that, you know, because thousands of Asian members have joined the party, that they're infiltrating the party.
Things absolutely, yes.
What do you make of the, you know, the state of the Labour Party in the light of this series, The Labour Files from Al Jazeera? And of course, another aspect of this is, isn't it ironic that we've got to look to Qatar in order to see a really decent investigative documentary into what's going on here in the UK and in politics?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I agree. How ironic is it that the BBC was the main leader of the anti-Semitism allegations in the Labour Party, and it's refused to comment on the Al Jazeera files and what it said about its own propaganda broadcast, Is Labour Anti-Semitic, the Panorama programme, shown shortly before the general election in 2019. What it shows is the campaign against anti-Semitism in the Labour Party was never about anti-Semitism. We see that today when, if you like, if you're Jewish in the Labour Party, you stand a 5 or 6 times better chance of being expelled or suspended than non-Jews. Starmer's rooting out of anti-Semitism was really about rooting out anti-Zionism. And that was the problem with Corbyn. He was seen as a supporter of the Palestinians. And so what they've done is redefine anti-Semitism, not as hatred or hostility to Jews, but hostility to Zionism. That's how it was done, through the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition, or misdefinition, as I call it, of anti-Semitism. It equates hostility to Israel, hostility to Zionism, as hostility to Jews. And of course, that's always been a Zionist trick, to equate Zionism with being Jewish. And today, more and more people see that, just as more Jews see that as well, that Zionism has nothing in common with being Jewish. It's a, in many ways, it's an anti-Jewish movement. So, yes, I mean, Al Jazeera revealed everything, the naked corruption, the racism, the skullduggery, the thuggery, the abuse that was leveled against people on the left. And they, you know, all these racists in the Labour Party suddenly became anti-racist. So you had this demonstration outside Parliament called Enough is Enough. You know, who took part? Norman Tebbit, one of the worst racists in the Tory Party, who invented the cricket test to suggest that Indians and Pakistani immigrants to Britain weren't really British. So, I mean, you had all of that, and it was a disgusting mixture. And, of course, the mass media in this country, the BBC included, willingly participated in it in order to discredit Jeremy Corbyn. And in the end, they did, because Corbyn didn't fight back. He accepted the narrative that there was this anti-Semitic phenomenon in the Labour Party, which never, ever existed. And I can say that. I was the first Jewish person to be expelled from the Labour Party as part of this nonsense.
Well, okay, so the other, I mean, the sort of quid pro quo from this Al Jazeera series and the detail that they go into is pretty shocking. They've got the people who were literally right in the middle of the Labour Party at the time experiencing this, giving first-hand accounts of this, these despicable, racist, backstabbing policies that were being adopted in completely, you know, we say clique-like terms. So you're either in the clique, and if you weren't in the clique, you were going to be stabbed in the back if you spoke your mind. This kind of way of running a democratic political party, of course, is not democratic. But I suppose result of all of this was that, because Corbyn was being undermined to such an extent for so many years after he became the leader of the Labour Party, you had all these people who were being, these wages are being paid by the trade unions, donations and membership donations to the Labour Party. It's almost certain that the 2017 general election would have been won, which was a knife edge as it stood, would have been won by Jeremy Corbyn, and he would have been Prime Minister. That's
right.
That is the most shocking thing about it, is that we missed out the opportunities of a really genuine left-wing prime minister, because not just of the incredible assault by the London press, the right-wing London press against Corbyn, who hated him, the army, who definitely didn't want him anywhere near the seats of power, but it actually the final slam dunk was by the Labour Party itself, destroying Corbyn from within, and he wasn't in a position, it seemed, to even fight back. I wonder what would have happened if he had won that general election, as he should have won.
I don't know whether he would have won it, but even if he had won it, I think you would have found a majority of Labour MPs would not have supported Corbyn as Prime Minister. I mean, that is reality. But what we had during that election was the chief Labour staff, led by Ian McNichol, actively campaigning against the Labour Party in the election. I mean, they targeted ads on Corbyn's group on Facebook to make it appear that they were doing something when they were actually sabotaging the campaign, refusing to put money into Tory marginals.
It was a knife-edge election where the Democratic Unionists held the balance of power. I mean, almost certain that, without Corbyn being undermined from within, without his own party actually trying to help him to win the election, which is their job, that he would have won. So, I mean, I just think, because of the fragility of the result in that election, he almost certainly would have.
Yes, I mean, we saw in many ways a secret coup within the Labour Party, sponsored by the British establishment, the BBC, the press and so on. The Guardian was a major, major culprit. The Guardian was worse than any other paper under Jonathan Freedman. They campaigned using anti-Semitism, so-called anti-Semitism, in order to discredit Corbyn. The tragedy, of course, was that Corbyn bought into this narrative. He kept denying how he was anti-Semitic without ever understanding that when they talked about anti-Semitism, they didn't mean hostility to Jews, but hostility to Zionism and the Israeli state. That's where Corbyn, unfortunately, did not understand what was happening. And the Labour left camp capitulated, with John Lansman of Momentum, of course, buying into this nonsense. And so it was used as a weapon to attack the left, and they were successful because it gave them a kind of moral righteousness, which, support for austerity and so on would not have given them. So it was a clever trick. Unfortunately, too many people capsized, if you like. I mean, I realized when I was suspended in 2016 what was happening. This was a ruling class establishment campaign to undermine the left and the Labour Party and prevent, as you say, a radical prime minister becoming elected. And in 2017, they had an absolute fright when they realized that Corbyn came back from about 23 points down to nearly win an election. I mean, that gave them such a great shock, they redoubled their efforts afterwards in order to undermine him. That is the tragedy.
Back to your book, Zionism During the Holocaust, The Weaponization of Memory in the Service of State and Nation, by yourself, Tony Greenstein. You wind up, don't you, by asking some, I think are very important questions about Israel today. And the question you one of the final little sections in the book, you ask this very important question: is Israel actually really a Jewish refuge? Because a lot of Jews now are saying, well, actually, it looks to me as if the current regime in Tel Aviv could be dragging this us into a war in this region, and maybe it wasn't the best place to come for some kind of safety and shelter.
Yes, I mean, Israel is not a refuge against anti-Semitism. On the contrary, if you're Jewish, you're more likely to die in Israel because of the conflict there than if you live in the diaspora. So it's not only not a safe refuge, but it's an extremely right-wing racist state in which Jews who come from liberal countries, American Jews and so on, do not find themselves really at home there. It's an extremely intolerant state. It's a state where the far right is becoming stronger and stronger. I mean, you have a Jewish Nazi party, the so-called Religious Zionism, which is predicted to be the third largest bloc in the Knesset. I mean, they advocated, making sexual relations between Jews and non-Jews a criminal offence, for example, which is straight out of the Nuremberg book. So, I mean, yes, Israel today is a horrible and frightening state. I mean, even the left Zionists are now reduced to a fragment of the Knesset. They used to run the government up to 1977. Today, they'll barely get 10 seats between them. But, I mean, they themselves have completely been assimilated into the right. They also support the colonization, the West Bank in practice. So Israel is a far-right state, which is really only supported by the most racist and reactionary and anti-Semitic regimes the world over. I mean, that is the irony of setting up an ethno-nationalist state. Because when you do that on the basis of religion, you call it a Jewish state, automatically it means you discriminate against those who are not Jewish.
Yeah, if you go back to the 1990s with Yitzhak Rabin, I mean, he was doing a terrific job in actually what looked like a genuine peace settlement. And then, of course, he was assassinated. So what happened there?
Well, he was assassinated, of course, by the far right in Israel, encouraged by Netanyahu, incidentally. Who feared that the Oslo Accords, which he negotiated with the Palestine Liberation Organization, might lead to concessions which they didn't like. In reality, it was a very clever agreement. I mean, I attacked it from the start because it created a Palestinian quisling leadership in Ramallah under Yasser Arafat and now Mahmoud Abbas, which basically... It replaced the faces of Israeli policemen and soldiers with Palestinian military. It never ever talked about a Palestinian state, incidentally. People misunderstand the Oslo Accords. It was never aimed at that. In many ways, it was aimed at furthering Israeli colonization of Palestine, and it did that. And it replaced, if you like, one of the main instruments of oppression of the Palestinians today is the Palestine Authority itself. It's a military subcontractor of the Israeli state and the Israeli army. So, I mean, the Oslo Accords were an utter disaster. But today, you're seeing the rise of Palestinian resistance on the West Bank. Two Israeli soldiers and officers, I think, have been killed in the last week. So the Palestinians, despite the fact they're, you know, they're surrounded and outnumbered and so on, they're fighting back against the fierce military repression, despite the Palestinian Authority. So Oslo was an utter disaster. Yitzhak Rabin himself was a war criminal, let's be under no doubt. He was in charge of the expulsion from Lod and Ramla during 1948. There was nothing particularly brilliant about him at all, but of course he was assassinated by the right because the Oslo Accords still gave too much to the Palestinians because they want to give nothing. I mean, that's reality.
So anyway, you've done this terrific job on Zionism during the Holocaust, which is about all about this kind of weaponized term that's been kind of hijacked, really, considering the other Holocausts of history, we're supposed to forget about those. But anyway, what the main question,
yes,
Tony, now,
yes,
is how do people get hold of the book?
Right, well, the book will be published imminently. At the moment, I've sent you a proof copy, but it will be published. I can't give you a date, but it will be within the next month, I have no doubt. If people want a copy, just send me an email, and I'll tell you how to get it and when to get it. My email, I read it out now, it's Tony Greenstein, one word, treble1@gmail.com.
You better spell the Greenstein, Tony.
Oh, Greenstein is green, colour green, then Sugar, Tango, Echo, India, November. So that's Tony Greenstein, STEIN, 111@gmail.com. I will give you details of that, and details will be released shortly.
Things like social media and blogs, anything like that you could like to...
Yep, read my blog. I mean, my blog... Just Google Tony Greenstein's blog and details will be forthcoming.
Tony Greenstein, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Tony, as well.